Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. The Greater Tulsa Indian Art Festival gets underway tomorrow at the Glenpool Conference Center, featuring native art, foods, and entertainment, along with my guest today, the festival's poet in residence, Suzanne Schoen Harjo. While Harjo is a talented poet, the Oklahoma native is perhaps better known as an activist for Native American rights. As president of the Morning Star Institute and a former director of the National Congress of American Indians, she was instrumental in the creations of several laws to protect American Indian rights, the 1978 American Indian Religious Freedom Act, the 1990 Native American Graves Protection and Repatriation Act, as well as the creation of the Smithsonian's National Museum of the American Indian. In fact, she is a curator for Native history and will curate a new exhibit at the museum opening this year. She's also been instrumental in the efforts to get the Washington NFL franchise to change its name from Redskins. She was a plaintiff in a patent and trademark case and is still involved in current litigation. And she's been an advocate against all sports using stereotypical Indian sports team names. Suzanne Schoen Harjo joins us today on Studio Tulsa. Suzanne Harjo, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Would you start by reading a poem for us?
Well, I'll read a poem called Macacalypto, and that is a combination of macaca and apocalypto, brought to us by around the same time by one person who was trying for a Senate seat and another who was trying for big box office with a not-so-good movie. And so this is kind of my version of that. Macacalypto. It began with La Danza Macabra. It began with clouds floating on water. It began with men in boots on the beach. It began with men with metal heads. It began with men with hairy faces. It began with men in robes and ropes. It began with men with crosses and Bibles. It began with bows and outstretched arms. It began with open hands and smiles. It began with gestures from the heart. It began with names repeated slowly. It began with hands to mouths and bellies. It began with hungry men at dinner. It began with laughter and songs of joy. It began with a dance from across the sea. It began with rats from El Nino ships. It began with fleas from mice and men. It began with labored breathing. It began with chills and fever. It began with hollow eyes. It began with cold blue lips. It began well, but it ended, well, badly. It ended as a danse macabre. It ended with fixed eyes. It ended before anyone knew what happened. It ended with white men welcoming us to our own countries. It ended with white men making no trespassing signs to keep us out. It ended with white men making movies about how we brought it all on ourselves. It ended with the drunken marriage of Mel Gibson and George Allen. It ended with La Danza Macabra, Macacalypto.
That's a very nice poem. I love that line. It began well, but it ended well badly. A wonderful poem. And thank you very much for sharing that with us. Combating racism has been a big part of your life, especially when it concerns Native American and fighting for the rights that have been written down on paper but not always lived up to in American history. How important has poetry been in your life, considering all that work on the activism front?
Well, sometimes slogans and laws and statutory language just don't cut it. Only a poem will do. And sometimes I just have to retreat into a space where words and the music of thoughts exist. You can sometimes put a little poetry into presidential proclamations or speeches on the House or Senate floor, Mostly it's pretty, which I often write. I write under other people's names and in other people's voices. And then, of course, I do a lot of collaborating with many, many people on writing laws or writing things that become federal law, because those are always written by committee and by far too many people for anyone's good. And once you've had done with that kind of writing and that kind of speaking, it's wonderful to move into another kind of truth, because what I do in writing, doing my part to make federal law, is I'm writing the stipulated truth. It's mm-hmm. not the truth. It's what everyone agrees to say is the truth at that particular time. So the legislative history of a particular bill is not really the history. It's what everyone says is the history. So to go from that kind of stipulated truth to something that is actually, in my case, in my poetry, factual, or what I imagine is factual, to go into that kind of truth and to really just play with sounds and with words and with their various meanings rather than their various truths, trying to make something as truthful as possible and not a false positive as you often get with the other kind of writing that I do. So to go into that is a relief, actually. It's the difference between growing onions and growing peonies.
One nourishes the soul and the other one nourishes the body, I suppose.
That's right.
In a way. Well, one of the things I was struck by is, as you well know, contemporary Native Americans live with a foot in both worlds. You know, the contemporary America that we live in, and then in many cases, that traditional world that survives to an extent and sometimes even thrives today in their traditional culture. And it seems like you probably have more than 2 feet, because you have those feet, but you also have the feet of being in the artistic world and yet being in the world of dry law and factual, straightforward, or sometimes not so straightforward, interpretation of law.
That's right. And then also at the same time, much of my life and work involves ceremony.
Mm-hmm.
Not just Cheyenne or Muskogee ceremony, which would be enough and too much, but but Lakota ceremony, other ceremonies where I've been privileged to be a part of, and much of that is for its own sake, but some of it is I'm really expected to convert that into protection of a sacred place or protection of a particular religious freedom. And I do that. That's what I do, what I help do. Native ceremonies play a vital role in my life. When I went to live in New York from Oklahoma, I looked around for the nearest Native community or Native nation, and the nearest one that did traditional ceremonies was Onondaga Nation near Syracuse. And so I started working very early on with the Haudenosaunee, the Six Nations Iroquois Confederacy, and especially with the Onondagas, who are the fire keepers, the center of the Haudenosaunee, the people.
Mm-hmm.
And I still return there often and do a lot of work with old friends. So some of it is ceremonial and some of it is actual work. You know, how do we protect certain rights? How do we protect certain places? I'm also involved with protection of sacred places across the country and with protection of Native American religious freedom generally. So with almost 600 Native nations in the United States, and with many of them having religions and many of them having emergency situations regarding protection of sacred places and certain religious rights, I have a lot to try to help with. And part of that is helped with being a part of ceremony, But it's not necessary, because you don't need to know the details of someone's religion or someone's ceremony in order to figure out what's right,
right,
and what needs to be done. What needs to be done is what the people say needs to be done. And that's the kind of thing that I spend a lot of time convincing people on Capitol Hill about, and in the federal agencies.
Well, if I can just take, for example, I know you were very instrumental in the Native American Graves Protection Repatriation Act from 1990, as well as probably the executive order that the Clinton administration did on Indian sacred sites. How good is our track record today in protecting those sacred sites? Is it a matter of every day there's somebody attempting to develop a site that could be sacred to a group of Indians or Native Americans, or is our track record a lot better these days?
The track record, it's not every day. I would say, though, once a month there's some genuine emergency where, almost out of nowhere, some Native nation will be hit with the awareness that a gold mining company from Canada or some other foreign country is going to mine in your sacred area, and they have various permissions, and you don't have a say in it because it's under NAFTA.
Right.
Native nations don't have a say under NAFTA, not even a right to a hearing. Now, that's a real instance that happened to the Quechan tribe with Glamis Gold Mine from Canada.
And I know it can be as simple as, I know sometimes the sacred ceremonies are no longer owned by the tribe, and I think that's probably the assumption that the tribe owns all their sacred areas, and of course many times they don't. I know there was a instance in southwestern Oklahoma where the previous landowner had always given permission for the tribe to gather at a particular site on his land now, but when he sold, all of a sudden there was a new company that wanted to come in and do some gravel excavation. They're working ahead on their plans, and because this was sort of just a handshake agreement, they were unaware, and all of a sudden the tribe finds out at a very late stage that this site where they'd been gathering each year was going to be a mining site.
Yes. In the 1800s, in 1880, the United States Secretary of Interior developed some civilization regulations. That's what they were called. And basically, they were in place until the 1930s, so for over a half a century, and they outlawed everything that had to do with anything that was traditionally Native. So
a forced assimilation.
It was forced assimilation, and these were unilaterally defined offenses that had to do with things like roaming away from the reservation to a sacred place, and sacred places that were outside reservation boundaries, or oftentimes within reservation boundaries, but had been confiscated or given away through allotted processes. The people would get arrested for going to those sacred places, and then, because no one was going to the sacred places, they were declared surplus to the Indian needs, and they were part of the public domain.
Or I would think maybe the government actually wanted to sell those sites as a way to keep Indians from gathering at those sites as well,
well,
I would think.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. They wanted to stop everything that was traditionally Native. And so the sites were under attack. The people were they called the so-called medicine men, who they referred to them as pagan and heathen. People were killed, and the penalties were imprisonment, which could be open-ended, and starvation, which also could be open-ended. And you can imagine that people just took their religions, and they also took their languages and everything else that was Native tradition. They took it underground, and some of these never reemerged, but some did. And even after years of the regulations being lifted after 1936, some of the people were afraid to talk about the religion or talk about a place, and a lot of the places did not get protected because no one knew who they were, where they were, or because there was no assault on them for several decades, no one said anything about them. You know, they just let things be. Or, as you said, a handshake.
Right.
There was just an understanding about a certain place, and then there wasn't.
Exactly
so
right.
Every Native nation has experienced this at least once, and it has created a pretty much of a crisis today. So these places need to be protected one way or another, and there are many models for protection, some where the properties have been turned over to the people, to the Native peoples. Another is where co-management or co-joint stewardship arrangements have been worked out, and another is just cobbling together protections under existing laws and regulations to protect a certain place. Now, the other way is to let a place be destroyed. Well, that shouldn't be an option. And these places are national treasures, even if no one understands what goes on there. People don't question that a Catholic church or a Baptist church or a Methodist church is a sacred place. And no one would say, all right, tell me which point of this sanctuary and which point of this altar and which point of this room or this property is more sacred than the other. What do you want, and which is the most significant? We wouldn't do that. I mean, Native people wouldn't do that. We'd just say, that's sacred. Okay, that's the end of that discussion.
I guess it's pretty hard to get convince others, isn't it, sometimes?
Well, respect is something that you cannot teach, and we've learned that you can legislate, actually. You legislate something that is sort of like respect, especially if it comes with a subpoena.
My guest today is Suzanne Schoen-Harjo, a poet, a writer, a curator of fine art, and a Native American rights activist. She is the president of the Morning Star Institute, which upholds Native rights. She'll be the poet in residence for the Greater Tulsa Indian Arts Festival this weekend, and she's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. We had a poem earlier, but right now I'd like to really talk about your activism, which we have been doing, and I want to talk about the case that you've been involved with for a number of years. You were a key participant in a court case involving trying to change the name of the Washington NFL franchise. We all know the name of that slurry word that Washington goes by. And you actually had some success in a patent court, and it was a really interesting discussion because apparently you can't have a patent and a trademark for a word that is a slur or derogatory. Is that correct?
That's right. And our case, it's under the Lanham Act, 1944 trademark law, that says you can't have a license, a trademark license, for material or a name or a word or an image that is disparaging or that holds people up to contempt or that holds people or an institution or an organization or a person up to disrepute or is scandalous. So there are those four prongs, and we filed suit in 1992 against that terrible name and won in 1999 with a three-judge panel unanimous decision from the Trademark Trial and Appeal Board of the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office, and we won on three of the four prongs. It's disparagement, contemptuousness, and disrepute. And we spent the next 10 years defending the judge's decision because the Trademark Trial and Appeal Board or the Patent and Trademark Board, like unlike other federal agencies, don't go into litigation themselves because they're used to deciding cases between Coke and Pepsi where they figure it out themselves, or, you know, they have enough money to have a lawsuit that goes on forever. So our 17 years was spent in the other side slowing things down. And so the Federal District Court overturned the trademark judge's decision and said that each one of us had waited too long after turning 18 to file the suit. and it was an equitable affirmative decision by a judge, so they can just make it up. So that's the unique interpretation that this judge came up with, that we had just waited too long.
So you found some young plaintiffs.
Well, that's right. While the case was making its way through the appeal court and up to the Supreme Court, request for the Supreme Court to review, which they did not, and that ended the case in 2009. But in the meantime, in 2005, I started looking for younger Native people who wouldn't have this latches problem, this lag time, as the judge had decided it, this technicality. So that's the case that's live now, and called the Black Horse case. These are young Native people, and it's the identical suit to ours, the identical forum, the identical case history. Everything's the same, except the young plaintiff's depositions are different. They are their own depositions, and then ours were not a part of it. But everything else is the same. Their case couldn't start until 2010 because ours was still moving. And when the Supreme Court declined to review on latches, then the young people's case started moving, and they just had a hearing in March. And they will, in our case, yeah, and no one knows how long judges take, but in our case, it was a little less than a year from the time we had a hearing to a decision. And in this case, March was the hearing, and so we're thinking that the decision could come any time soon. In the meantime, the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office attorney examiners have started declining requests for new trademarks for that same despicable name, and they have started releasing information that they have done so. So there are 11 of those that they have declined with the same name as the Washington franchise. In the meantime, there were some new requests for trademarks that had stacked up over the course of our litigation and the Black Horse litigation. And so those are also captioned Harjo et al. Versus Pro Football, Inc.
Yeah.
And they're waiting, being held in abeyance pending the outcome of the Black Horse case. We're not through, and this is only one cause of action and one forum, and it's generational already.
Well, as you well know, the Washington owner, Mr. Snyder, has basically vowed never to change the name, and I assume that the NFL is pretty adamant against changing the name. But I think if they lose their trademark protection, I mean, one of the main reasons for keeping the name is all the money that revenue makes in. And if there's no trademark, there's no money.
That's right. They will lose the exclusive privilege of making money.
Off the name.
Yes. And our suit is not about the racist name they want to use. Our suit is about what the federal government should protect. And should they protect that racism? Should they protect that disparaging name? And we say no, and the Patent and Trademark Board, the judges who know most about this have said no, that they should not protect this. And they, in our case, they said that they were wrong to have granted the license to begin with, starting in 1967.
Well, let me ask you, I know that, you know, this gets into all this emotion surrounding this name, and I'm sure you've heard this argument that this is not a derogatory name, it's an ennobling name. How do you respond to that? Because, you know, as you well know, we have a school district in Tulsa County that goes by the same name, and they make those same arguments, that this is not meant to be derogatory.
This has never been an honorific, and it is not now, and it never will be one in the future. It is not something that, I mean, on its face, it's derogatory. You can't characterize someone by their skin color. But this goes deeper. It goes back to bounty hunting days when Native people were actually skinned as proof of Indian kill. And the skins were given sometimes the scalps, which they called the top knots, and sometimes the genitalia, because you had to prove that it was an Indian man or an Indian woman or an Indian child according to some of the bounty proclamations. And the only way you do that is either with the whole body or with the genitalia. So this has heinous origins for us. And you don't even have to know that or care about that, as we do, to know that it's prima facie. On its face, it is discriminatory, and it is disparaging. So Union High School coaches and administrators and teachers, for all of you who are telling kids that this is an honorable thing, or that it's right to even say it, to even use the word, shame on you. And for Daniel Snyder, I have to say he's not the first owner of the team who said never. All his predecessors have said never.
How do you feel about the prospects of that eventually changing, at least in Washington? Do you think that's...
I think it'll change. I mean, since we collectively started working on these issues, the University of Oklahoma's Little Red became the first mascot that was supposedly Native American to be eliminated at any place in America, in American sports. We have been working steadily and winning steadily. We're on the downhill slide. There were over 3,000, a little over 3,000 when Little Red fell in 1970. And now there are a little over 900.
Yeah, that's pretty good progress. That is good progress.
It is pretty good progress. Over two-thirds are gone. That is a societal sea change in the American psyche. And we're not really talking about if, we're talking about when. And I have no doubt that even though no professional team has changed anything yet, that except Cleveland, which has made some steps recently toward possibly eliminating Chief Wahoo, who's the graphic equivalent of the name of the Washington franchise, even though those 900 contain all of those professional sports, and our progress has been made only in educational athletics, with some notable exceptions like Union High School, we're still winning this issue. These are going to be consigned to the history books and to the museums. They're going to go the way of the lawn jockeys. Anyone who's clinging to these names and these images is really on the wrong side of history, and certainly on the wrong side of this issue. And I have no doubt that this will, that they will all be gone in the not too distant future. When that will be, I don't know.
Suzanne, thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks so much.
Native American rights activist, poet, writer, and curator Suzanne Schoen Harjo speaking with us here on Studio Tulsa. She'll be the poet in residence for the Greater Tulsa Indian Art Festival, which takes place this Friday through Sunday at the Glenpool Conference Center. That's located at Highway 75 and 121st Street South. She'll be reading poetry throughout the festival. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. If you missed one of our recent programs, they're available online anytime at publicradiotulsa.org. I thank you for listening. I'm Rich Fisher.